Good evening, it's 6:30. The national media firestorm over the shooting death of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin has many states looking at their versions of a law called Stand Your Ground. Kentucky has this law, and we'll look into it on Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. This is Front Page PM, our weekly evening news magazine, taking time to talk to leaders and dig into issues in our Four Rivers region. We also bring you Front Page AM Friday mornings at 8:35 and the hour-long Front Page Sunday at 9 a.m. Tonight, we focus on two different issues that face our legal system, justified homicides and funding cuts. The so-called Stand Your Ground law cited in the media recently as justification for the killing of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin is under scrutiny now. Kentucky has a similar law, where essentially someone could use deadly force against another person who's threatening their life. To help shed more light on this law in Kentucky, I'm joined by Commonwealth's Attorney Mark Blankenship. He serves Callaway and Marshall counties. Mr. Blankenship, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First of all, if you could just explain to me Kentucky's Castle Doctrine, which is essentially the Stand Your Ground law.
Right. The Castle Doctrine, for those historians out there, goes all the way back to the 17th century, and Sir Edward Coke started. That was an English idea that the home is your castle. So when we're home, we're in our castles, and so if in the middle of the day or the night someone is breaking into my home, I do not have to ask them why they're there or warn them. Our law says that is a reasonable apprehension of fear, the fact that someone is in the castle that's not supposed to be there. So I can use deadly force within the home without any sort of warning, without even knowing whether this person intends to use deadly force on me. Now, I would caution any citizen to be as careful as possible before you pull the trigger, to make sure that the person in your home is not someone that has a legal right to be there.
When did Kentucky adopt this Castle Doctrine?
We've had it for a long time. It got improved, I guess you could say, in 2006. They added some language to include not only your home, but an occupied vehicle. So if I'm out in my car and someone is trying to get in my car, it's the same as coming into my home. There's some language in the statute that says if wherever you are, you have a legal right to be there, then you do not have to run and retreat if you're confronted with force. That will not be later held against you that, well, you had an option. You could have just run. You could have left. But if I have a right to be where I am and you're coming at me with deadly force, I don't have to run. I can return deadly force in exchange for deadly force. Now, just because the law allows us to do that doesn't mean as citizens we don't have a duty to each other, you know, the ethics of the situation. And what we don't want to ever do is with these laws that someone couldn't use these laws to kill somebody. Like me inviting you over to my home, nobody knowing that but me and you. And so I've invited you over and I'm expecting you, but instead of that, I've decided to kill you. We want to have a situation where the facts really justify. Every case has to be looked at. And you don't want to, by going overboard with these laws, create a situation where people abuse them.
Who looks at these cases? Who makes the decision whether or not you can press criminal charges?
It's a combination of a lot of people. I've heard this by my detective and other people that have been around law enforcement a long time. The first police officer on the scene is really the first judge on the scene. So the first one there, as they gather evidence, and then it's looked at with a lot of different eyes. We're taking a case to a grand jury this week where a man was killed. He was along with his girlfriend, and we don't have all the facts yet to sort it all out, but they apparently had a legal right to be there. They'd been invited over to an apartment, and this was an apartment building setting. Something goes a little bit haywire at some point in all this, and the victim and his girlfriend end up going into another section of the building, which is not an apartment. It's just a little area. 1 year ago, I think it was a laundromat or something, but now it's like a little work room, and it's very small, about like the area we're sitting in here, which is not very large. And But they bring weapons for some reason. The girl has a weapon, and the man that gets killed has some kind of a stunt gun or something. And the witnesses, all that we have are the people that were inside there, are making them to be the aggressors. And somehow in all of this, the defendant that was originally charged with murder was able to get the gun away from the female and shoot the male. But in that process, see, the police are looking at it. I'm looking at it as Commonwealth attorney. I've had my Commonwealth detective go look at it. And now we're going to have 12 people on a grand jury look at it. So in all of that, it's being looked at to determine, was this what we refer to as a justified murder? I mean, the guy intentionally killed another human being, which is the definition of murder. But it's justified in certain circumstances. But did he have the right to shoot him? The defendant saying he was unarmed, they're charging him, and he did what he could to save his own life and to save maybe the other people that were in there. And so if the grand jury, when they hear all that, if that's what how they see it, which is sort of the way I see it at this point because I don't have any other witnesses. Even the female has now killed herself to make any sort of case. I needed her, and she had an appointment with my office. And 2 days prior, she kills herself.
It's not always cut and dry in a situation like this.
No.
When you add the vehicle in as a possible dwelling, and if you use deadly force and you use a gun, are you required to have a permit to have that gun with you?
We have the carry permit. You can carry a weapon in our state, but you're to demonstrate a little competence.
So if someone, though, didn't have those permits, but then they were in their vehicle and they used deadly force on someone to protect their vehicle, their property, but they were illegally possessing the gun, how does something like that work out?
That's a really good question. The statute doesn't really address that. I think it would still come down to whether there was a reasonable apprehension of fear. The person that ends up doing the shooting needs to be able to prove that they had a reasonable apprehension of fear for their own life, that they thought something was about to happen. It's imminent, and to defend myself or to defend someone else in the car, I use deadly force. When it's real close like that, it's going to come down to a jury question.
What if it were a fight that could potentially turn deadly, but in a rural area, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and you're on somebody else's property?
You mean like a land between the lakes or something?
Sure, yeah.
People are camping, and they're packing weapons.
Yeah.
Those are probably the most difficult at all.
So
that's sort of like you have in the Martin case. You know, they're out. They're not in a residence. They're not in a car. They're just out on a public sidewalk, and this thing occurs. And that's what makes that case so tough. And you've got the 911 call where he's told not to pursue him. So, you know, here in Kentucky, we'd be saying you didn't have a legal right to be where you were because you were told not to pursue. And now, if I look across, you know, in a public area, in a subdivision or in, say, an apartment building, and I see someone breaking into someone else's home, 911 should be called immediately. But now, as a good citizen or as a good Samaritan, I'm still wanting to help. So I've called 911, but the law, it's going to take a little time for the law to get there. So I go ahead and grab my weapon, and I go over to where this place is. Now, I would be allowed to use deadly force if there is proof, and I can see it, that the person is broken into that home, has deadly force, and they may be getting ready to kill the person that lives there. I would be allowed under Kentucky law to use deadly force to save my neighbor's life.
Do you think all of the focus on the stand your ground law is justified based on the Martin case?
No. No, I think that's been sensationalized a little bit. Of course, it's such a tragedy, too, that it breaks people's hearts, all of us, to think about a young man like that gunned down and then he's unarmed. So, you know, we just hate to see that in our country. But then when you throw in the different races, it makes it even more complicated.
I'm assuming that you don't think Kentucky will look again at its stand your ground law based on...
We haven't had any kind of case that I can think of that's given us a lot of problem with this. Most of the self-defense things seem to work themselves out along the way.
Commonwealth's Attorney Mark Blankenship, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
American Bar Association President Bill Hutchinson was in Murray this week as part of the Murray State University Harry Lee Waterfield Lecture Series. Hutchinson touched on an issue facing many states in today's tough economic climate, finding the money to fund state courts when the money just isn't in the budget. Shelley Baskin spoke with Hutchinson about court funding and what the ABA is trying to do about it.
As far as the state court systems go, where is this underfunding coming from? This is not being put into the state budgets?
The economy, as we all know, since 2008 has been on a severe downturn, and the demand on legislators for government funding has been great in the face of reduced revenues. So it's understandable that legislators have a difficult time choosing where to allocate state revenues in such a difficult period of economic crisis. Unfortunately, the courts are not being recognized for what they are. The courts, by constitution, are one of three co-equal branches of government and need to be funded as such. Last year alone, in 2011, 42 out of 50 states cut court funding in this country, and not a single state in the United States allocates more than 4% of the annual state operating budget to the courts, and too many states allocate less than 2%. So when the courts are underfunded, they're less able to provide access to justice, and access to justice is critical to our constitutional democracy.
And you mentioned the access to justice, but what specific parts of the courts are being hurt by this?
Court vacancies are being left vacant. Court staffs are cut back. Court clerks are not available to the judges. Six states in the last 2 years have actually closed one day a week, and the courts have only been open in those states 4 days a week. New Hampshire, the Chief Justice closed the courts for an entire year for civil jury trials. In California, where the courts have suffered over $600 million in cuts in the last 4 years, in the fall of 11, 29 out of 63 courtrooms were closed in the San Francisco Bay Area, and 40% of the court personnel were laid off. In New York, on the other coast, on the other side of the country, when Governor Cuomo's administration came in early 2011, his administration immediately cut $170 million out of the court system there, and that's in a state where trial judges had not received an increase in compensation, including no COLA increase, for 12 years. So the courts need to be adequately funded, and when they're not, their ability to provide needed dispute resolution, domestic relations, decision-making, and so on, is significantly compromised, and the quality of life in our representative democracy is qualified and compromised and less and less and less. We do not want an urban spring here. We want access to justice.
You touched on it a little bit, but what kind of changes would an individual notice when the court system's underfunded?
Well, let's take the situation in New York as an example. Since the $170 million in cuts last year that I referenced earlier, the courts have now been required for financial reasons in New York City to close the courts at 4:30 p.m. every day. 4:30, everything stops. At lunchtime, everything closes. People clear out the courthouses. When they come back, they have to go through the metal detectors. There has to be security. And then at the end of the day, let's say a witness is on the witness stand, only 5 or 10 minutes to finish. The witness has come from out of town at expense to the client, but the court says no, 4:30, that witness has to get off the stand because we're clearing out the courtroom. That means that witness from out of town has to stay overnight to testify and finish up the next morning, an extra night in a hotel room, extra meals, penalties for changing the airline arrangements. All that cost has to be borne by the client. It drives up the cost of litigation.
And as the president of the ABA, you have a pretty powerful voice on what should be happening in the courts. What's the ABA doing to stop the underfunding?
We're active on a number of fronts. We are partnering with civic and community and business groups, such as the Chamber of Commerce. I've done a joint op-ed in USA Today with Lisa Ricard of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We are publishing op-eds and articles in publications all over the country. We are speaking all over the country, as I am doing here. We're getting the word out so that the general public understands and appreciates how serious this crisis really is.
Well, Bill, I thank you for joining me today, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
The full audio of ABA President Bill Hutchinson's lecture, Justice on a Shoestring, The Real Cost of Underfunded Courts, is available online at WKMS.org. When we come back, we hear about an unprecedented fundraising opportunity for a Murray State sport. This is Front Page PM from WKMS News. This is Front Page PM. I'm Chad Lampe. Kentucky's lawmakers were in veto recess this week, where the governor looks over proposed legislation and then either signs or vetoes. Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Hallett about what happens during this recess week and what's ahead for the state budget.
Well, it's been a quiet veto week, hasn't it? We haven't heard much out of the governor.
Yeah, it's been very quiet. I don't know if it's a combination of basketball early in the week and now later in the week we're around Easter time, but it's been very quiet. He's signed maybe six or seven bills, smaller issues that aren't really controversial, and I expect that means that next week we're going to see a very busy week. That veto pen will probably get a workout, especially in the budget bills.
Let's talk about some of the bills that have been passed or that or have not been passed. The auto incentives bill, what is that and what's going on with it?
Well, that bill the governor signed on, I believe, yesterday. And basically what it does is it provides millions of dollars to auto companies that meet certain thresholds. You have to have 1,000 employees, you have to be in business in Kentucky for 5 years, and you have to be willing to invest $100 million in your Kentucky businesses. So basically, it's a wide program, but it's a small one at the same time. This is what led Ford to invest in these Louisville plants, both their plants to help them retool, to help them hire shifts again, you know, second and third shifts. And now this law allows that to happen for Toyota, for General Motors, and two of the biggest suppliers, auto suppliers here in Kentucky. Toyota is really a big fan of this. They can do this tomorrow if they want to. They say it makes them competitive internally. If Toyota wants to build a new plant in the United States, Kentucky would obviously, if they built that plant, that would qualify for these incentives. If they want to start a new car line, they can do it here in Kentucky to get these incentives. And so everyone seems to be rallying around this, and it's a really kind of a slam dunk proposal.
Now, early on in the session, there was a big push for the creation of charter schools, lots of advertising. That bill appeared to be dead for a while, but where is it now?
Well, it seemed that it was going to, there was a deal on the table for a pilot project, something like 20 charter schools statewide in the last few days. But when they tried to attach that bill to another bill that House Education Chairman Carl Rollins had, he kind of got a little frustrated and upset and declared both of those issues dead on arrival. And in the last day, you know, obviously there's negotiating to get bills out of both chambers. And so basically that charter school amendment on one of Rollins' bills was taken off of it so that the Senate could get one of their education bills through the House. So basically supporters are saying it's dead for this legislative session since there's only one day left, but they promised they're going to come back in 2013 even harder than they did this year.
And what about there was a bill for Cole County scholarships? What's that about?
That one might be in trouble. I mean, there seemed to be an agreement on the table for this bill to get out as part of budget negotiations. It was originally, you know, we were talking about the University of Pikeville becoming a state school. That didn't work. So they created this scholarship program for 12 to 16 far eastern Kentucky counties. And that seemed to be okay. They would pay coal severance tax money. But in budget negotiations, the Senate changed that a little bit. And from there, what they've done is they've expanded to all coal mining or coal producing counties. That's 38 counties in all. You're talking about Eastern Kentucky, Western Kentucky. That was part of the budget negotiations. And then suddenly, on the last day, last Friday, that bill does not pop out of the Senate like it's supposed to, like everybody planned on it. The Senate says it just got lost in the shuffle, but there's a little concern on the House side that that bill's either being held hostage or could die once again this coming up Thursday.
You've done some political reporting. You've had a chance to catch your breath a little bit from all the legislative activities, and you've been talking a little bit about the 4th District primary. This is the 4th District congressional race.
That's right, yeah, which actually now, you know, is kind of like a cap on the state. I mean, it already was, but now it shoots all the way in eastern Jefferson County, all the way down to Spencer, and then it goes all the way to Ashland on the whole other side of the state. And so this primary has, you know, a bunch of Republicans in it. That's really where the race is. It's a Republican district. And these Republicans have finally started going after each other. I guess they realize the spotlight's on them. Gary Moore, who's the Boone County Judge Executive in Northern Kentucky, accused state lawmaker Alicia Webb Edgington, who's also running for that seat. She missed the budget votes, and Moore says that she was in D.C. fundraising, she was in Shelbyville fundraising, and that's really kind of I guess you're not doing your responsibilities as a state lawmaker if you're not there to vote on the one bill that you're required by law to vote on. Of course, Alicia Webb Edgington's campaign has said we're going to file those votes when we get back. We're going to vote no. They won't change the outcome, so they're not that important. And so they're battling back and forth. Thomas Massey, who is seen as the Tea Party guy in that race, has picked up a few endorsements. He's in forums. He's throwing a few punches. So these Republicans are starting to get at each other's throats. And I assume that the rhetoric will just increase more and more as we get to May 22nd.
And, of course, the presidential race continues to drone on or heat up, depending on your perspective. But an Obama for America office is now opened in Kentucky.
That's right. And basically, the Obama campaign, you know, make no mistake about it, most people believe Kentucky is a Republican red state when it comes to presidential politics. And I don't feel like the Obama campaign feels any differently, but they say they have a nationwide campaign. They're going to compete in all 50 states, and they say opening a Kentucky office proves that we're going to compete in all 50 states. Say it'll be a statewide office for, you know, not just the Louisville office. It'll serve the whole state. And they even kind of hinted they might open more offices in the future. I'm sure resources and time and how well they're doing in the race all dictates that, but they said you could possibly see Lexington offices or other offices out in the state, which would actually be contributing a lot more resources than people believe the Obama campaign will play here in Kentucky.
One quick legislative question before we let you go. We're on the veto recess. Lawmakers come back to where they can override vetoes. Can they pass any legislation during this time?
Yeah, they actually can, but they don't have any safety over it. So if it's a bill that the governor does not like, you know, obviously he can veto it. That's the concern about the coal county scholarships we talked about. That's also a concern about the prescription pill bill, House Bill 4 that we've talked about, that they won't have that protection. And lawmakers have gotten really nervous because in the past few cycles they've passed budgets without veto protection, and it makes them really nervous because this governor has shown that he's not afraid to use his veto pen. So any bills that haven't been already passed, even if the governor says he supports them, there's always that chance that they could be amended and he could just take his little red pen and X them out.
All right. Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS Newscast, and you can find his online stories at WKMS.org. While Murray State's men's basketball receives national attention, large budgets, and large donations, other sports like the Murray State Rifle Team spend more time under the media radar. But as Drew Adams reports, it hasn't stopped two former riflemen from raising a staggering amount of money in just 2 months.
Kelsey Emmy is a freshman from Piedmont, South Dakota. She's bubbly, outgoing.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say to that.
And she's likely a better shot than you. Emmy is an up-and-coming member of MSU's rifle team, and much like another racer team you may have heard of, she attended this year's NCAA tournament in her sport, competitive shooting. She narrowly missed the finals, landing only 4 points short. But unlike the Murray State basketball team, the rifle team struggles to keep itself funded.
Oh yeah, rifle is a fairly expensive sport.
A collegiate shooter typically competes with their small-bore rifles or air guns, and those can run in excess of $3,500.
There's also, like, little things, equipment. Sometimes we get a new suit or so, and that's usually about $2,000. Yeah.
To put that in perspective, the average cost to outfit an MSU football player, pads and all, is around $600. And for the rifle team, there is an ever-present need for lead and brass. The rifle team has been funded to cover all its expenses, but in this economy, everyone is looking for ways to boost their coffers. And two former Murray rifle teammates found an almost too-good-to-be-true option. Bill Beard and Ernie Vandizandi, backed by generations of former members, discovered an opportunity through the Scholastic Shooting Trust and the Midway Foundation. These two groups, along with their founders, Larry and Brenda Potterfield, would match donations at an unprecedented level. Scholastic Shooting Trust Director Dick Leeper.
So last year, any school that sent in a donation, the founders would match it 6-1.
So for $100 donated, the organizations added $600. That offer, though, only lasted for 2 months. So Beard and Vandizandi made a list of former members of the Murray State Rifle Team and called each one to inform them of the opportunity. And on it went, every day, for 2 months, Ernie and Bill presented their case to prospective donors. Ernie Vandizandi.
It was a long and cumbersome effort, but a work of love. It was just amazing how many past members of the shooting team had that same feeling that Bill and I did.
As the months progressed, the two began seeing results. $100 check here, $500 there. As the money came in, Beard asked Vandizandi how much they'd finally be able to offer the rifle team.
And I said, well, I don't know. I think we might get maybe a total of $10,000. And Ernie was saying, well, I don't know, if we raise $2,000 more, I think we'll be doing good.
In a few weeks, they blew by both guesses, and the totals kept growing, $15,000, then $20,000. Then 30. Finally, December 31st came, and the two discovered, in all, 78 former shooters, alums, and even former competitors donated $50,000. When paired with the match, the total staggered Ernie Vandizandi.
We ended up with $343,300. Yeah. We were blown away, believe me. It was great.
This money is a permanent endowed trust in the name of the Murray State Rifle Team. Beard and Vandizandi are still raising money, but even if they never add another dime, rifle coaches will have access to nearly $18,000 per year to keep racers like Kelsey Emmy shooting. For WKMS, I'm Drew Adams.
This has been Front Page PM, our regional news magazine following Marketplace at 6:30 on Fridays. You may have missed Front Page AM today, now a regular feature at 8:35 on Friday mornings. If you'd like to hear any of these stories or any of our stories again, you can find them online anytime at WKMS.org. You can also catch us this Sunday morning at 9 for our hour-long program Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe. Thanks for being with us.